Hi, I'm Bill Fay, General Manager of the Toyota Division. Behind me is the all-new 2017 Toyota Prius Prime, the best hybrid we've ever made. Welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash and John McElroy, episode 350 for October 7th, 2016. Hybrids mild and Prius Prime. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube. Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us. You may be wondering why we had Bill Fay open the show and not John, who is not here, or me, who is here, because we had an opportunity to drive the Prius Prime a couple of weeks ago, as well as two of my colleagues here, Christy Schweinsberg from Ward's Automotive and Joe Cesney of the Oakland Press. Mm-hmm. So we'll be talking about the Prius Prime later on. So that's a little special. Thanks. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Doing great.
Good, good. Okay, good. And our very special guest, Mary Gostansky, who is the Vice President of Engineering and Program Management for Delphi. Now, okay, so if you're not familiar with Delphi, Delphi is one of the top 10 automotive suppliers on the planet. Delphi makes all manner of things, all kinds of technologies, advanced technologies for the auto industry. And, you know, as a result of that, as we're in this era where technological advances are happening at a rapid pace, it's pretty cool to be able to have a vice president of engineering here to talk about some of the things that they're doing.
I'm glad to be here.
So, okay, 48-volt systems, you guys are going toward that in a big way. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. As we look at the advancements in the internal combustion engine, gasoline direct injection, variable valve actuation, diesel, the latest in diesel common rail, have done a lot to close the gap on performance and the required regulations for fuel economy and emissions. But they're getting stricter every day. And the OEMs are looking for the best value in electrification to be able to help close that gap. And we see that as 48-volt mild hybrid systems. So it's a hybrid, but just a little bit of an assist for the internal combustion engine.
But the 48-volt system's been around for a very long time, about probably two decades now. They've been talking about it in and out. Yeah. What makes this time the moment for 48-volt?
So excellent question. You know, over 10 years ago, I actually was the chief engineer for our generator business. And we believed at any point the systems were going to convert to, it was actually 42 volts at that time, right? And it didn't. It never happened. We even had our advanced generator designed and all ready to go for 2005. And it never happened. And you might say, why? Well, because it wasn't necessary. If you think about the automotive, the advancements move because there are regulatory requirements and because the consumer is demanding the next generation in technology.
They've already made the leap to connectivity without the 48-volt battery. And so
they have. The leap, though, that you need the 48-volt system, the hybrid system for, is to help close the gap on the nearing fuel economy and emission targets. If you think about 54.5 miles per gallon across the average fleet that an OEM provides, they are a long ways away from that 54.5 miles per gallon target. That's less than 10 years away. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for every advancement possible to be able to close that gap in their overall fleet.
So what segment of vehicles will get 48-volt? Trucks or SUVs or small cars? Where is it going to go first?
All of those. And it varies really not as much by the vehicles, but by region.
Why by region?
By region, yes.
So, okay, you said mild hybrid. Explain what a mild hybrid is.
So, good question. So a mild hybrid is really just a small assist to the engine, which means the main propulsion or what drives that vehicle down the road is still the internal combustion engine. The electrification is there to really provide a little bit of launch assist and maybe recoup some of the energy from regenerative braking that we've all heard so much about. When you move to a full hybrid, it really inverts. The main propulsion is now from an electric motor versus the internal combustion engine, getting you very close to a pure electric vehicle.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so we have a car out in the parking lot right now, okay, internal combustion engine. Now, there'll be another motor that will be involved in this. So it's just not the battery. It's just
right.
You're not just sticking a 48-volt battery in the trunk and saying, well,
exactly.
We're there.
Exactly. But we call it a minor conversion. So the way to think about this, and the reason why OEMs have grabbed hold of 48-volt mild hybrids, you can take an existing internal combustion engine with a small amount of modification, you can turn it into a 48-volt mild hybrid, which means that OEMs could maybe get there within a year and a half to 2 years versus a complete redesign to the powertrain system. So what does it take? It takes the existing alternator is removed and replaced by a 48-volt battery starter generator or a motor is the way to think about that. There's a small lithium battery, just enough to store the 48-volt power. There's a DC to DC converter to be able to take 48 volts and convert back to 12 volts to charge the 12-volt battery and maintain the rest of the vehicle. And then some wiring. And the wiring is very critical because what you need to do is adapt an existing architecture to run dual voltage. And then finally, what I call the secret sauce, it's the software. It's all the software that enables you to balance the use of that electric motor effectively with the internal combustion system motor engine.
Mary, what about cost? How does this relate to some of the other alternative propulsion systems that
perfect
we might
question.
Know better?
Yeah, perfect question. So when we look at a 48-volt system, a base system that I just described, anywhere from $800 to $1,200, and you might say, what's the difference? It really depends, and I'll talk a little bit about regions in a minute, but it depends on the size motor you're using, and that really is what drives the lower cost or the higher cost. When you compare that, what do you get for it? You should ask that question first. On average, 15% improvement in fuel economy. And it varies, again, depending on the vehicle and how you install it. When you think about a step to a full hybrid, let's just compare those two. Let's not go to electric vehicle, but just a full hybrid. Mm-hmm. Your add-on OEM cost is about $3,500. Now, for sure, more improvement in fuel economy, 40 to 50%. But a lot more cost. So when you look at the value of your dollar per fuel economy improvement, it's a lot more exciting for an OEM to take this small step first before moving to full hybrid. It's also, given the price of fuel these days, more advantageous for the consumer.
But you also mentioned that it'd be regionalization is important to the strategy at Delphi. Can you explain, go into that a little bit more, why regionalization? And I assume you mean like China, United States, North America, and Europe. Explain how that's going to play out.
Absolutely. So the two leading regions are going to be Europe and Asia, Asia in particular, China.
Okay.
Driven by the nearing regulation. So 2021, the European regulation, 95 grams of CO2 per kilometer hit by 2021. In 2020, we see almost the same type of regulatory targets for China. And so the OEMs are saying, I need to close this gap because the governments are going to impede some pretty high fines if their fleet averages are not compliant. And it's substantial fines. So in Europe, they're used to diesel. Its predominance is diesel. Mm-hmm. And consumers love diesel because they have high torque, a lot of power. So when we put on 12-volt stop-start system, and you're the consumer who's used to having this great power, the light changes, you step on the gas, and I say the car goes, bleh, right? And nobody likes that. And the first thing that the consumer will say, I'm not paying for that. Right. So the OEMs are saying, I need to give them a boost. Well, the best way to boost today without increasing the size of the engine, because we're not going to do that, that would take us the wrong way in fuel economy, is to put an electric booster, a turbocharger, so to speak, but electrified, mm-hmm. which means you need the power to run it. You can't get the power from the 12-volt. 12 volts are out of power. Where do you get it? From a 48-volt mild system. So the main driver in Europe right now is to get more power, to be able to put this e-booster on, to be able to give you this fun-to-drive vehicle that also delivers fuel economy or meets the CO2. Right? So that's the Europe driver. I will also say there's a side benefit with 48-volt mild hybrid. It helps you optimize your CO2 and your emissions. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to use it wisely, you might not need as much after treatment.
So you're burning less fuel because you're using the electric motor?
Absolutely.
So
torque assist for the engine.
So does it matter where the motor is located vis-a-vis the powertrain system?
So interesting. So we call it the poor man's version of 48 volt, which means it's the easy way to install it, is right in the same place that the alternator is today, right on the front end of the engine, right? That gets you, as I said, on average about a 15% improvement in fuel economy. The next step, they call it a P2, is really putting the motor between the engine and the transmission. And what that does is allows you to use that electric motor a little more, giving the engine a more of a rest and maybe getting about 5% more in fuel economy.
But what is there enough room in these engine compartments?
No. See, that's the thing, right? So that's what I was just going to say. From now till maybe 2022, you're going to see P0. You're going to see right on the front, easy installation, easy conversion, sell them, get the opportunity to get the fleet average improvement up, right? After 2022, by the time that the OEMs have time to redesign powertrain, they are going to put that room. They're going to look at putting it in there because it'll be worth the redesign. It'll be worth a little bit of extra cost to gain that and get the benefit. So you'll see a mix.
So this is 5% on top
on
of
top of that 15%.
Right.
Yeah.
20%.
Yeah, exactly.
Improvement in fuel economy just by adding this.
Exactly.
Now, does the electrical architecture still include the conventional 12-volt system?
It does.
So basically your car's rolling around with 60 volts?
Basically you're still keeping your same 12-volt system. You don't convert anything. In fact, what you find, and that was really the problem.
So you have two batteries in effect.
Two batteries, which is, again, a better cost option. Because you might say, well, why don't I just have a bigger 48-volt lithium battery and eliminate the 12-volt, right? And then you could just use a DC to DC converter and convert to your 12-volt architecture, right? The problem with that is the difference in cost, right? Lithium batteries still are expensive, and so you want to keep it small and keep the price down.
But from an engineer's perspective, this sounds like a very inelegant system. And I mean, the object is, I thought always in engineering was to simplify, but this
sure
seems like it's complicating the system. Can you?
It adds some components, right? Mm-hmm. But so the way we always think about it, we've supplied powertrain systems for years, right? We've done the evolution from what was Maltec to port fuel injection to gasoline direct injection. We've moved from diesel unit pumps to common rail. And it's always about the percent of fuel economy versus the cost to the OEM. And we always think about it, if you can get it in the $50 to $100 per percent fuel economy, that's the sweet spot. So when you think about 48 volts, mild hybrids, right, it keeps you in that sweet spot, a sweet spot that an OEM can continue
to cost
incrementally improve. Well, and get a consumer at the end to get a consumer to pay for and get the value out of. So I wouldn't say, could you have less components? Sure, but it's not about less components. It's about having a system that adds value to both the OEM as well as the consumer.
So you're solving
a problem.
So yeah. Does start-stop systems continue to exist?
Oh, absolutely. They grow.
With the 48 volt?
Yes. Yeah. So if you think about a hybrid, that's exactly what a hybrid does, is it helps the engine. The way you help the engine is by stopping it when you don't need it, right? So you can stop it when you're at a light. You can shut down the engine when you're coasting, when you don't need that extra power. There's different levels of hybridization, right, that really help you to save fuel.
But on the restart, it's peppier.
Yeah, it's much peppier because in larger vehicles, you add this e-booster, like I said, in Europe. In China, China's closer to that $800 range, right? They're going to go with a smaller motor. They're on smaller vehicles because that's the predominance of what's in the fleet. And they're going to use the electric motor to give them that extra boost. And I actually was just in China last week, rode in a vehicle. It was a larger van that actually had been converted to 48 volts. And without any e-boost, you notice a considerable difference after the stop-start feature because the electric motor is there with the instantaneous power to launch the vehicle.
But would the driver still feel that clunky sound that you get out of the
lattice? Not at all. Oh, not at all. And in fact, in our diesel system, we converted a Honda Civic and put this e-booster in, you feel like you're in a race car. You really do. Because when you hit the accelerator, it takes. It jumps. It takes off. It is a lot of the OEMs that have come to drive the demo, they said, 48 volts, we're not sure how much an e-booster would really do for you. We're thinking that it's not worth the cost because it's, $200 to $300 to add an e-boost function. And they get in the vehicle and they drive it and they say, tell us more. Please tell us more because our consumers are going to want this, right? And, you know, and we haven't really talked about North America a little bit, but North America, interestingly, they want performance as well as fuel economy. So if you think about North America, we're primarily gasoline. So what else can I do with a gasoline engine? Well, GDI is launched. We have variable valve action, so your air and fuel, great control for your engine, right? We can also do something called dynamic skip fire, which is really exciting. And you really control how many cylinders are going to fire on every cycle, which saves you fuel, right? And as a consumer, it's better than deactivation, where a whole bank of cylinders are deactivated. You do not notice that the cylinders are not all firing. You cannot tell. All you do is put money in your pocket, which is great. The neat thing is 48-volt systems complements the dynamic skip fire. So if you think about a GDI variable valve, you add dynamic skip fire, you get in a four-cylinder, maybe 8 to 10% improvement. You add 48-volt system, get another 15%. Now I'm pushing 25% improvement in fuel economy for my existing vehicles.
Okay, we have a question here from a person in the audience, first timer. It's a semantic question. Has the industry agreed that mild is the correct term for these systems?
Yes, I would say so. There's a lot of, and there have been mild hybrids out in the past that no longer exist. And that's where some of the confusion happens. In the industry, the definition of mild versus full is really how I started this conversation. It's the main propulsion is the engine versus the motor for a mild. In full hybrid, it reverses. That's the way they describe it. Not really driven by voltage. Your previous mild hybrids were actually about 140 volts. And they were also very expensive, by the way. They were almost a $3,500 on cost, almost as much as the full hybrid, with maybe just 10 or 15% more improvement than a 48-volt system, right? So no one liked those. That's why 48 volts is so attractive.
Mary, you mentioned that that strong hybrids still add a higher cost premium. Everybody expects that cost premium to be reduced, though, going forward. So is 48-volt a temporary bridge, or where are the legs of 48-volt?
I think you're going to see a mix across the board, right? I think you're going to see a part of your fleet that will use 48-volt systems, just like I've described, with other internal combustion engine solutions, such as dynamic skip fire, to really get an affordable solution, but yet great performance for the vehicle. I think you're going to see full hybrids out there as well, particularly suppliers that have already taken the step. So OEM that have already converted their engine manufacturing to large electric motor manufacturing capacity, they've already redesigned their powertrains, they're going to stay with full hybrids and they're going to keep going. And then eventually we are going to see a greater quantity of electric vehicles. That is going to happen, right? So I think 48 volts, just like internal combustion engine solutions over the years, are going to prolong the need to be a complete electric.
Have you designed a system, one of these systems, for a pickup truck? Because pickup trucks, while they're such a big, important part of the U.S. market, seem to have been a little slow to adopt some of this new engine technology. I was wondering if you could...
Yeah. Yeah, we have not put a 48-volt system on a pickup truck as of yet.
And why is that?
Just really because the demand first is really on the vehicles from the OEMs. They're looking for solutions and they're larger.
But pickup trucks have to meet the same standards?
But think about where the predominance of pickup trucks are. They're here in the U.S. And our standard is 2025. So the OEMs, not that they're ignoring it, but they have more time.
But architecturally, there's nothing.
Actually, there's no reason you couldn't do it.
It's just that this is where they're looking now. So
absolutely. What I will tell you is, on pickup trucks, we would actually recommend a dynamic skip fire solution first, as a first step, right?
Okay.
Because if you think about it, they're primarily eight cylinders. And what I didn't mention is, on an eight cylinder, we've seen as much as 17% improvement in fuel economy just by doing the cylinder control, so dynamic cylinder deactivation. Huge first step.
So is this because you guys have certain level of expertise in software engineering that allows this sort of thing to happen?
So a great question, because a lot of people ask me why Delphi. We do not make batteries, as you know. We do not make motors. That's half of the components. And they say, how can you really say you do a 48-volt system? Because the key for the system, there are really two secrets to it. It's the electrical architecture. It's being able to adapt the electrical architecture existing and add the dual voltage capability without adding a lot of cost, but still having the right protection. Because although we're talking 48 volts, and yeah, it's not considered high voltage, it still presents arcing and some of the other concerns that you have to be worried about. And then the second piece is, it's about how you use it, because otherwise you're just putting on $1,000 on average of cost and you're not getting the value. It's how you manage the use of it with your internal combustion engine software, right? Mm-hmm. And that's really what Delphi does. Mm-hmm. It's a menu. You tell us what you want, but we'll tell you how best to get there.
So when will we see 48-volt systems in market?
So the first systems we see launching within the next year, and those will be very low volume. That's OEMs actually tipping their toe in the water, so to speak, to see how they can best use it. You're seeing them first for power, just like I said. It's these premium vehicles in Europe that say, consumers will no longer buy it because they don't like the stop-start functionality. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., we just put the off button and turn it off, right? And in Europe, that's not viewed as the right approach. And then you'll see them ramp up around the 2019-2020 timeframe when the European and the China legislation is getting very close. You really won't see a large quantity in the U.S. until you get closer to the 2025 timeframe.
Will it be a hockey stick?
It is. It is somewhat. And it's a hockey stick that continues to grow. At every IHS estimate that I look at, about every 3 months, we see another increase. In the last year, it's gone from somewhere in the around 8 million units in 2025 to now projecting almost 14 million units of 48-volt mild hybrids by 2025. Which is a huge ramp, and you might say, well, what's driving that? And as we talk with customers, they're validating. They're saying, yes, what's in IHS, that's correct. And they're rolling out their plans, and they're deciding which vehicles and when, and that's why you're seeing that bit of a hockey stick. So, you know, is there still some cautious optimism? And as there always is, you know, you watch it. But I guess where we come back to this one is the regulation is there. It's not going to, they're not going to back off in any region of the world. And OEMs need solutions to close the gap on their averages. And if they don't, it's large fines. So they're going to look for the best value electrification, and it's coming full circle back around to being 48 volt, at least in the near term, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, final question from either of you two.
Where exactly does Delphi fit into the equation in terms of what they're going to, what do you offer the manufacturer going forward when you make your case for this system?
Delphi is absolutely the system integrator. We are on all fronts, whether it be for active safety, whether it be for the latest in connectivity or in propulsion. And so what we tell an OEM is, you want the best opportunity to get the value out of your 48-volt system, start with our engine management system, mm-hmm. put in our fuel injections, our pump, our engine management control. Let us optimize the hybrid control for the 48-volt system. Let us guide you to selecting the right size motor, the right size battery, and then using the 48-volt mild hybrid system to get the best value for you and for the consumer.
So ideally, you want to get in on the ground floor at the start of a product development program. This isn't a mid-cycle refresh technology.
It's really both. So we're talking, you know, about after a powertrain redesign is 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. We're talking to customers in that range. We also can go in and add just the hybrid control, so we can put it in a separate box mm-hmm. and interact it with other EMS software. There's ways to do it that way as well. So we're willing to optimize both ways to help our OEMs meet their challenges, right? Okay. That's what it's all about.
Okay, Mary, with that, we'll have to end the segment. And
we're
going to have
me.
To have you come back, because there's so much that Delphi is involved with.
Absolutely.
You mentioned in passing connectivity. I mean, you guys are big in that. Autonomy, you're working on that. We want to talk 48-volt today, but we'll certainly have you back to talk about the other things that Delphi is involved with.
Love to join
Thank you
yep.
very much for being
Thank
here
you for
today.
Having
it
me.
Was great. So, Thank okay,
you.
We're going to take a quick break here and hear from our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we're back. Before we get into the other news, Brock Yates died yesterday, and I think we should acknowledge the fact, 82-year-old man who had been the editor of Car and Driver and who basically was the person who was responsible for the Cannonball Run. And I thought it was very interesting that Carmen brought this picture up, and you can see there's Brock Yates and the speed limit 5 behind him. Well, the reason that he developed the Cannonball Run was because that's when the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was put in, and he just thought that that was just not right. So,
yeah, well, for better or for worse, Brock was very influential in shaping the auto industry, I think, from his position at Car and Driver. So.
Right. Yeah, he was a fascinating character, and so we have all the best to his family. So we actually have a couple of phone calls here. So we're going to listen to these. These are about, one of them is about a show that we did. We taped last week's show, so this is why this question is going to be there. So, Carmen, could you please bring that in?
This is Clem Zarovsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. As a former engine builder, race engine builder, I think the spec racing has just ruined racing. Even in NASCAR, nobody does any passing anymore except in the pits or on a restart. Used to be ingenuity in action was like what racing was, where you were smarter than the other guy, you deserved to win. But now everybody has the same thing. Every car goes the same speed, and it's really not racing. It's just the parade laps out there. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, so since Henry Payne, who had his Lola in here last week, isn't here to answer the question, I'm going to make up an answer to this question. And I think basically, Clem, that the reason that they're spec racing, because if there weren't, guys like Henry wouldn't be able to afford to race competitively, because people with big pockets and big money would develop cars that would go much faster than those who have limited budgets. So that's why I think there's Henry and his Lola 90. So I think that's why we have spec racing, and yeah, some of it may not be as exciting as we'd like to see it, but if you want to make it as fair as you possibly can, I guess that's a way of doing it. So then our next question, please.
Yes, my name is Rod Mahan. I live in Pueblo, Colorado, and I had a question about why Paul Elio hasn't looked into the fuel vapor technology. There is another car that's similar to that that gets over 100 miles to the gallon, and will do a lot faster, and is sporty, looking like a Corvette in the front. I would appreciate you looking into that.
So again, this goes back to a show we had two or three weeks ago when we had the head of engineering for LAO in the studio, and so they have had a three-cylinder engine developed for their car, and I think IAV did the work on that, and so. I don't know this technology that you're talking about with the fuel vapor. So I think that this exercise, though, in part that Elio was trying to involve as many brand name suppliers as he possibly could to develop credibility.
I think that was what they were trying to do. I'm not sure that they haven't really promoted that technology all that. I mean, the fact that they have the technology in the car.
Right. So, yeah, it's a curious one. So, anyway, want to thank you both. Hope you're watching today. Thank you both for your questions. And okay, guys, let's talk about Paris. Okay, so they had the Paris Auto Show, big auto show. Several companies didn't show up at the auto show because they didn't think it was quite as important. What is your sense of the show? Is Paris becoming one of these shows that exists because people like to visit Paris, or is it a show that people really like to visit because there's good stuff there?
Well, I don't think it's just Paris that automakers are sitting out, right? Everybody's looking at budgets and where their customers are and saying, you know, this isn't the show for me, that's the show for me. So mm-hmm. They're being strategic. Yeah, there were a lot of crazy luxury cars there that only the 1% can afford, but mm-hmm. that's every European auto show, right? Mm-hmm.
I think it's also a reflection of the sort of the weakness of the French auto industry that's mm-hmm. gone through a tough patch here, and they haven't had Renault and Peugeot and Citroën really haven't had much to show, and the home team always is the one that kind of energizes the show, and
right.
I don't think they had quite the mm-hmm. enthusiasm that they had in the past.
Okay, that said though, I think that there were two introductions in Paris that may be more important, more influential, more consequential than anything we're going to see introduced for a long time.
You're talking about Mercedes and Volkswagen.
Mercedes coming out with the Generation E Q. Like
I understand it's supposed to be a family of cars that it's going to sit underneath the Mercedes brand.
Right. And actually, Dieter Zetsche, the CEO of Daimler, said they're going to have a new sub-brand, in effect, called CASE, C-A-S-E, standing for Connected Autonomous Shared in Service and Electric Drive. So he sort of is fudging there with this thing. And he says this is going to be the four pillars that will be important to Mercedes going forward. And so they showed a concept coupe that will have a range of 310 miles. I mean, that's sort of the bogey that a lot of people are going for. And yes, and the other one is the ID that Volkswagen showed. And so this is going to be a vehicle that they're going to be bringing out, and they're saying turn of this decade with 373 mile range. And they too, I mean, there must be this German thing about four pillars of things. Theirs is based on smart sustainability, automated driving, intuitive usability, and connected community.
Well, Volkswagen just wants to get away from the as far away down the road as it can from the diesel, from the wreckage of their diesel mess.
Uh-huh.
And I think this is kind of a way to do that, or a way to point that they're getting diesel behind them.
Right.
And
very amusing to me, because these automakers for the longest time have, I don't want to say dissed electrification, but they've certainly not been out there like Nissan and General Motors and some of the early adopters have.
Right.
So it's a little late, okay. I think, the enthusiasm, but I'm glad it's coming. I mean, I'm a fan of electrification.
But you know, the thing that strikes me, though, is that, okay, and I agree 100% with you,
basically
you had the Europeans who are saying that diesel technology is the way forward.
And Mercedes and Volkswagen, as Christy mentioned, were in the forefront of that.
Right. But what I find to be interesting now is in both cases that we have Volkswagen saying, you know, we have this whole new modular architecture that we have built specifically to create electric vehicles, okay, a whole new architecture that we're going to come out with 20, 25 cars. Mercedes basically saying almost the same thing, that, you know, we're going to have a whole bunch of these things. And it isn't like the one-off that we're seeing many of the more traditional guys do. I mean, these guys seem to be, I mean, first of all, they're big companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be placing big bets on full electrification.
One thing I did notice in Zetsche's comments, and I'm sure the executives from Volkswagen would have told you the same thing, that a lot of this is geared to the Chinese market, where both of them want to be very, mm-hmm. you know, Volkswagen, China is Volkswagen's biggest market. And some of this is they're feeling the pressure from the Chinese government to electrify vehicles as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly some of this has kind of a regional bias towards their interests in China.
Right. So
this also reminds me of the BMW i group of vehicles, which mm-hmm. at this point sales have been underwhelming for.
Right.
And we're hearing that BMW is pulling away, not necessarily going to get rid of i, but going to incorporate electrification into its mainline models.
Mm-hmm.
So this plan of Mercedes to have unique
right.
vehicles, we'll see.
Well, it may work, it may not work.
Yeah.
But
well, that raises an interesting question. Why would Mercedes follow a strategy that hasn't worked for BMW? Yeah, exactly.
Well, but if you think about it, I mean, so BMW basically has the i3. That's the only full electric vehicle that they have. And then they have the i8, which is a hybrid that costs in excess of $120,000 or something
right.
like that, right? I mean, so you know, it's not like they're, you know, so basically, I mean, let's take Volkswagen rather than Mercedes. I mean, Volkswagen's basically saying, okay, when we come out with our ID car,
mm-hmm.
we're going to price this in the region of a Golf, okay? So it's going to be a more common car for lots of people.
Which is very strange, too, but that's a whole other
discussion.
We'll
see how that works out. Okay, we got to take another quick break. We're going to come back, and since I am Dr. Data and I am sitting here, I guess I will introduce Dr. Data. So you guys all put your thinking caps on, because I'm going to ask you what this number means.
Okay.
So let's take another break.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
And we are back. Okay, so I have a number which we'd like to bring up on the screen here. Okay. 86.5% is a pretty big number. There's sort of a clue in the background. If you guys go, okay, what could this? You're really squinting now, looking hard.
Oh, okay.
Okay, Christine, is Christine.
Is this relating to Jaguar Land Rover?
Sort of. Joe, anything?
No. I'm
no? All right. So let's bring up the answer. That's percent of the 2.63 million cars sold in the UK that were imported. So 81.5% were imported from the EU. And, gee, didn't we just hear that they're going to get Brexit moving?
So what are the British English going to drive after they...
isn't that the question? And then, I mean, what Carlos Ghosn was saying earlier this week about he's concerned that there may be a Brexit tax on the vehicles that he's manufacturing in England.
Sunderland, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a big factory. They make a bunch of cars there, right?
A lot. I want to say capacity is 400,000-ish. It's big, yeah. Mm-hmm. Honda has a big plant in the UK.
Toyota. Right. Toyota's got a plant in the UK.
Everybody has.
Jaguar Land Rover is.
Yeah.
Right, and they just built a new engine plant in the UK. Right. I mean, so obviously the UK needs to have cars too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so the British people. But I mean, I looked at that number and I thought, how astonishing that is. I mean, how are they going to be able to adapt? I mean, let's just say that they have to have, 5-10% tariff on that.
Well, I think this is one of the details that the political figures in Great Britain and in Luxembourg, where the European Union is based, are supposed to work out in the years to come. But it is a very, very real challenge for the automakers, who are very concerned that this whole thing could fall apart and then leave them with facing very steep tariffs on cars that they import into Britain and no place to export vehicles. You wouldn't be able to export back to the European continent, which is, I'm sure, is what Mr. Ghosn is concerned about.
At least there's good public transportation in the UK.
There is good part, to a degree.
Yeah.
So you know, we were talking before the break about technology, and I meant to ask at that point. So, Christy, Wards just had a user experience conference and awards. So explain to us what UX is and what you guys discovered.
So Ward's 10 Best User Experience Awards and Conference came out of this idea or this reality that there's so much going on in the interior now in terms of technology. You've got so much telematics, so much advanced safety content in the vehicle that our 10 Best Interiors Awards we felt like we couldn't adequately judge all of that. So we're doing 10 Best UX now. We gave out the 10 awards on Tuesday in Novi, and we had an associated conference talking about all manner of user experience, head-up displays, haptic, wearable technology, or actually not wearable technology, but sensors in seats that will make you sit up straight, improve your posture, judge your overall health, which is important for the semi-autonomous future in case you need to take over driving. Mm-hmm. The car wants to make sure that you're willing and able to do that.
So if you have a gripper, then you may not be able to drive your car.
Yes. Lots of talk about infotainment in relation to the smartphone. How can we make the car more like the smartphone? How can you better bridge the technologies? Of course, there's Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, but automakers want to keep people focused on their own systems.
But it all seems to me that basically, you had a situation where the automakers wanted their own systems, and now they're all like rushing to put in Apple CarPlay and Android Auto because they feel if they don't have them, that people won't like their cars.
But they're only add-ons to the systems that their own systems that are in the car.
Right. I mean, they're giving the people what they want, but I think ultimately they want to make their own systems more immersive and exciting.
All right. What's more immersive? Explain that to me.
Well, just more functionality, more personalization. It was said that the if I can find it here, I have my notes. Okay, so customization of HMI, more flexible displays, enhanced features. All of this will require more computing power and storage capacity than smartphones are capable of. So supposedly cars will make a comeback versus the...
Okay.
CarPlay and...
The idea is that the phone doesn't have enough intelligence or to do mapping and all the other things that they think these systems will do.
I believe that is the idea.
Well, but I mean, if you're rolling around and you have like 500 gigs of music that you need to have, and then you've got like several movies that you want the people in the back seat to see, and then you have the navigation system that your phone isn't going to be able to do that. So you're going to need to have some enormous hard drive, and so you might as well put that in the trunk, next to a lithium-ion battery to power it or something.
Yep. Some of the takeaways: HUD will become the dominant display and source
heads
of information.
Up display, looking straight out and seeing this thing that's
right
on some sort of a screen.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So HUD's coming.
Augmented reality HUD is also coming.
So what is augmented reality HUD?
So that is basically putting the ADAS icons on the screen.
So this is automated driver assistance system.
Right. So you're going to get the lane lines actually on the lane lines. You're going to see the blocks. You know how you set the distance within adaptive cruise control system?
Right.
You'll see the blocks visually represented between you and the car in front of you. If you've got a mapped route set and you have a turn coming up, you're going to have little arrows that move in the direction of the turn that's approaching, so you know.
Or perhaps the landmark that you're supposed
right
to turn at.
Right. So it's bridging.
So when's that coming?
Before 2020.
Oh, yeah, the systems are, I think, are pretty close to the outcome.
Yeah, I drove in Germany a Continental system that had all that stuff, and it was pretty clever. I mean, it showed you. So the point being, you keep your eyes on the road, and you're not glancing over at something else.
Another thing we talked about, monetization of apps. Of course, there's already subscriber services out there. Sometimes the apps are free. So there's a possible revenue stream there for automakers to monetize apps and maybe have a la carte apps where you pay $3 or $4. And that's seen as a sort of a Netflix type model where it's not that much money that shows up on your monthly report and you say, I gotta get rid of that, it's costing me too much,
Right.
Don't make it annoying for the consumer, make it affordable.
So like your expensive SiriusXM subscription.
Much cheaper than that though. Yes. Large displays are coming. Apparently in China, the economy cars soon are going to get 12-inch HD screens.
We're going to talk about a big screen in a few minutes here.
Okay. Let me see. Chimes beyond seatbelt alerts, which doesn't interest me very much. Mm-hmm. I find audible warnings annoying, but mm-hmm. they're going to be coming at you from all different directions.
Yeah.
And different sounds for different adaptive safety technologies. Proactive technology is coming. So the car will know, for instance, if you're going to have a baby in the family, and it will tell you about the latch system.
Well.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so this is a question that came in from the chat. I've used Apple CarPlay in a number of rentals I've had over the past couple of months. It is so far superior to any of the manufacturer systems. UX should default to Apple or Google CarPlay.
Well, that is one of the problems. I mean, I think there are car makers are very afraid that that's what's going to happen, is that they'll lose this valuable space in the car to people like Google and Apple. And so they would prefer to keep it within their
right
within their family.
Mm-hmm.
But the viewer is absolutely correct. I mean, some of these systems, the Google and the Apple systems seem to be a little bit easier to use than
right
some those from the manufacturers.
Okay. Let's take another quick break here, hear from Bridgestone, and then we're going to come back and we'll get to the Prius that we saw at the top of the show. So, excuse me. So, our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, and we're back. And so, as I mentioned at the top of the show earlier this month, I think it was, we were
last month.
Okay,
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks. We were all out in California, and we had the opportunity to drive the new Prius Prime plug-in. So we'll show a little walk-around that I did. So, Carmen, could you please bring that in? Here are the three quick areas you should look at to be able to identify the 2017 Prius Prime plug-in hybrid vehicle from the 2016 Prius liftback version of the car. So, first of all, the front of the vehicle
we see these headlamps, this quad headlamp configuration, which is actually inspired by the Toyota Mirai, the hydrogen-powered vehicle that Toyota has brought to market, because this is an advanced technology vehicle having the capability of going 25 miles on pure electricity alone. They wanted to up that a little bit. Another feature here is you'll see this. This is a piece of clear acrylic, not easy to say. And below that, there's actually a texture. So they wanted to put that in there so people would be able to see that there is a difference between this and the 2016 Prius liftback. Now, as we go along the side of the vehicle, which incidentally is 4 inches longer to accommodate a battery that's twice the size as the previous generation Prius plug-in, you'll see that in the center of the console, there is an 11.6-inch touchscreen that operates exactly the way a smartphone operates. So you can pinch, you can zoom, contains navigation and a variety of other applications that Toyota's brought to the vehicle. Now we're at the back of the car. This is the third big area that's different. Now, for those of you who are familiar with the 2016 Prius liftback, you'll know that there's a lot of vertical lines here, vertical lights. In this case, it's more horizontal, in addition to which this glass actually curves down and up like the gulls of a wing, and it's even picked up here in the sheet metal. Part of that is aerodynamic. Part of that is purely they wanted to have a little bit of distinctive flare back here. And finally, in the back of the vehicle, a huge difference is the fact that the entire hatch structure is made of carbon fiber. This is actual carbon fiber, not carbon fiber. This is made in the Motomachi plant in Japan, where they make the LFA supercar, the Lexus supercar. I'm told by the chief engineer that this is one of the largest and most complicated carbon fiber components of any vehicle that Toyota has on offer. And the reason, of course, using carbon fiber rather than using aluminum or some other material is that it's lightweight and strong and does the trick for the hatchback. So with that, you got those three things. The front, look inside, see that big screen, and back here, the lamps, the shape, and of course, if you open it up, the carbon fiber structure for the liftback. Okay, and that's me back. I saw that I misspoke, and I said, I should have said the wings of a gull, and the gull of wings, and which makes no sense. All right, so you guys were in the car. What'd you think?
I liked it more than I thought I would. Going in, I was ready to judge it by its relatively small or short electric range.
25 miles, which is how much more than...
Well, the previous one was 10 to 15.
Right.
I was never clear on that because the number was always changing, I think. But, yeah, so this is definitely an improvement from the previous one, but still not as much range as you got with the first-gen Volt. However, this is a much less expensive car.
Right.
So I think that they should be able to sell this. And they are going to be selling this now in all 50 states, whereas before the first gen was relegated to California. Mm-hmm. So I think they have good possibilities mm-hmm. with this.
How about you, Joe? What'd you think?
I thought the package was well integrated. I thought it drove nicely. It was quiet. Obviously, it's efficient. And I thought it had adequate power. I mean, one of the knocks on the old Prius is it doesn't have a lot of... Mm-hmm. punch, and this one seemed to have a little bit, at least enough to keep up with traffic. The other thing that impressed me was the fact that you could recharge the vehicle in a 120-volt outlet in 5 hours, which I thought was an impressive step because you could...
So this is just a normal outlet that
right, you could actually take
in
it
a
somewhere.
Wall somewhere, so you could actually have one here and plug it in.
Yeah, you could actually take it somewhere and just... You could go to your relative's house and plug
right.
it in, you could then drive back on electric power if mm-hmm. you live within 25 miles.
Right.
But
another advancement is you can drive up to 84 miles per hour, I believe,
right.
on electric,
right.
which is much, much higher than.
It's illegal, by the way. I just want to tell you that right now, Christy, no 84 miles an hour.
I'm out on 96
I'm
right
just
now.
Saying you got to take that into account.
Okay.
So you can't do that.
But it could get up to that speed
That's
without
right.
much of a problem. So, mm-hmm. which was a.
If you're being chased
change.
By zombies or something, then
clowns.
Clowns. I understand it's
right.
a big problem around here now. The thing that surprised me a little bit, though, was the fact that. It's a four-place vehicle, not a five-place vehicle like the liftback or the normal Prius.
Right. I think it was explained that there's some components in that middle
right.
seat position.
Right.
So.
I mean, they didn't right. do it just because they wanted to.
Right. Right.
And I'm sure they had a discussion about let's realistically, how many people drive with have
three passengers.
Mm-hmm.
I
mean, four
passengers rather than just three,
yeah,
or even three.
How many people have five people in the car? It doesn't happen too often.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So we got some comments in the chat room. Clever way to sell primes. Make the lift back so ugly that you'll pay premium for the less ugly prime.
It is a face only a mother could love.
I think the prime,
especially in the back, that it's a really nice look.
And the extra length seems to give the design a little bit more of a, make the design work a little bit better, but mm-hmm. not much. It's still
all right. Comment two: the carbon fiber melted in the middle, which. So, Christy, you and I, we talked to the chief engineer, and he explained to us that it is actually even more exaggerated when the designers worked
first
on
did it.
First did
it, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
I was surprised that they...
They did that?
They let the designers have that free reign. That's.
But it provided an aero advantage.
It did.
Minor,
it
but
did.
An aero advantage.
It did.
Mm-hmm. And then the third comment, the Tesla-like screen is cool, though. So this gets to your point of the user experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove with Christy, and she was doing all kinds of tests of that while we were driving it.
Right. And I was going to say, for our UX competition, one of the things we judged on was surprise and delight, and that includes the little mini-movies that are becoming more prevalent now in vehicles, and mm-hmm. the Prius Prime has a very good one, both at startup and shutdown. And, yes, it is a very large screen, and this is, I think, the largest screen we've ever seen in a Toyota.
11.6.
It looks like a direct lift from the Tesla, though. You're right about that.
That was one of our chat room people. And well, the Tesla, though, I think is 17-inch. I mean, it's not as big as that. But, I mean, when you get in that car, you can't help. It's like, holy moly, look at that mm-hmm. thing. And it doesn't look like an iPad mini. It looks like a full-blown
Right, and
iPad.
It's flat. And it's
right,
yeah.
And you can swipe it and
right.
pinch it and do all that sort of stuff. Okay, so this week's sales numbers came out.
Mm-hmm.
So, not that bad. Not that
they were
good.
Flat.
Yeah,
right.
You know, but I guess that's better than being.
But they're flat at like 17 million plus. So that's
right.
Yeah. So.
But I mean, there were some serious surprises that I discovered when I was looking at that. And so, for example, here's the thing that really caught my eye when you knew that something was not perhaps as it could be. That so Ford sent out the press release for mm-hmm. its sales, and the first sentence of the press release is. Ford Transit vans U.S. sales grew 6% last month with 10,799 vans sold.
That's because everything else at Ford.
Right.
Down.
The second sentence. Yeah. Overall, Ford U.S. September sales totaled 204,447 vehicles and 8% decline versus a year ago. Okay, so you start out saying, oh, we sold a whole bunch of Transit vans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised they didn't play up the Continental because they sold first month of sales 775
yeah.
more than Hyundai did of the Genesis G90. So that's mm-hmm. you know
yeah.
a win there.
Yeah, and it was like to the point of Ford, not a single car had a plus sign in front of its sales.
Yeah,
nor did the F-150.
No, nor did the F-150. That's absolutely right. And what I thought was really astonishing is speaking of trucks, is that the Ram mm-hmm. outsold the Silverado.
Yes.
I mean,
is a big surprise.
Is the Rensen, like, shaking right now? I mean, so Silverado was down 15.5% September over last September, and it's down 3.5% for the year. What's going on there? What do you think, Joe?
Oh, I'm not sure that the trucking market is exhausted, but I think there's, you know, I mean, we're down to... The people who want to buy trucks are, you know, contractors and stuff like that. And that part of the economy is still a little bit, still has room to grow
mm-hmm.
or hasn't grown as fast as it should have, as people would like to see. And I think that's inhibiting some of the growth in pickup.
What's your take, Christy?
I think the Ram appears fresher and newer
mm-hmm.
than the Silverado or F-150. I think there's some interesting... design cues inside and out that makes it stick out, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I think a lot of truck drivers like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of pickup drivers.
So
like
and it's sort of ironic because I think the Silverado is actually a newer truck than the Ram is,
mm-hmm.
but the designers over in Auburn Hills have been making these tweaks to, mm-hmm. to the RAM to make it, you know, visually look mm-hmm. different. And
also, the RAM has a very strong interior.
Mm-hmm. They do.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah, so, that was interesting. But, you know, Jeep was down. Chrysler was down. Dodge was down. Alfa was down. Fiat was down.
Fiat was way down.
But RAM was up. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's amazing. Jeep was down. I mean, it's just like, mm-hmm. that hasn't happened for, like, ever.
I know. No, that is surprising. Yeah,
probably 4 years.
So, I mean, like, you know, what's
Why?
Happening there?
Maybe some of their negative third-party survey results are catching up with them.
Yeah. Now, one thing that we were just talking about the Prius, and so, you know, there's the fact that, yes, indeed, you know, Prius sales are down, and, you know, everybody's saying, oh, gasoline prices and Prius, oh, nobody wants hybrid cars and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I looked at the Prius number for the year. Okay, so this is just mm-hmm. the Prius liftback. This is not the Prius Prime that we saw, not the V.
Or the C.
Or the C. And so they sold 78,372 for the year so far. That is ahead of all Buick cars, mm-hmm. which is at 66,000, more than all Cadillac cars, 49,000. Outsold the Camaro, which is 54,500. Impala, 74,000. More than the Jeep Compass, 72,000. Renegade, 77,000. 344,000. Charger, 72,000. Challenge. I mean,
it's definitely a relative decline. They're judged against their own prior success.
Right.
And there has never been a new Prius that has performed this poorly. And I did a story in July where I looked at what the gas price, the national average for a gallon of unleaded was when the third and the second generation Priuses came out. And it was under $3 a gallon, mm-hmm. even adjusted for inflation. So, I think maybe the styling or the success of the RAV4 hybrid, which has been, I think they've done 30,000 RAV4 hybrids this year. I think that might be.
So, but that sort of cannibalizes them, right?
Yeah.
More than.
People come into the showroom and they see the RAV4 hybrid sitting there and you get the utility. I mean, I know you get utility with the liftback, but you probably get more cargo capacity with the, mm-hmm. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Toyota succeeded in building the hybrid business, but. To Christie's point, I mean, when you look for a hybrid, you only go to Toyota. So, like, the RAV4 is a good alternative for buyers in the hybrid segment, in mm-hmm. what is basically a separate segment all of its own.
Right.
How's the RAV4 hybrid, Gary?
It's great.
I know somebody that owns one.
You do. but, you know, it's sort of the, you know, You were mentioning that, you know, the first month of Continental sales, I should mention that the Prius outsold of all Lincoln cars, too.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So we have a question here from Chuck Granenci. Are Sierra sales flat, up, or down? Maybe that's the reason for the Silverado's decline. Sierra was down 8.5% for September. And it's up 1.7% for the year. I think that maybe part of it is that Colorado, the midsize, was up 41.6%, and it's up 26.6% for the year.
There's some cannibalization.
I think those trucks are so big themselves
that
you really don't need to get the bigger one, right?
Yeah. Some perspective from the Ward's data department. Historically, small pickups do best in the second quarter, but General Motors' re-entry into the segment 2 years ago reignited demand. So they had a strong third quarter, mid-size, small pickup. We call them small, but really they're mid-size. They had a strong third quarter, and
really
expected
they're semi-giant.
To have, yes, exactly.
They're still tall. They're still 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm. And they're expected to have a strong fourth quarter, so that might mean more down sales months for the larger pickups.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Christy, you and I had a chance to talk to Bill Fay, who mm-hmm. was at the top of the show and did the introduction, and we were asking about Camry, mm-hmm. saying, you know, gee whiz, what's going on here? Now, Camry still is the number one selling sedan.
It is.
And so it's still beating Corolla, Accord, Civic, and Altima. But What do we see happening there? Do we see at some point where the RAV4 will be outselling the Camry, and that we'll have the Nissan Rogue outselling the Altima? And
Nissan says it's going to happen this year. It's happened the last 2 months, and I think they're only 1,000 units apart right now, January through September sales.
And even Bill Fay conceded that the RAV4 could become Toyota's best-selling vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're predicting 400,000 RAV4s by next year. Traditionally, the Camry's been the only vehicle in their lineup that's sold at that level.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably won't happen next year, but maybe 2018, 2019.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a phone call. Can we bring the phone call in, please?
This is Clem Zarovsky in Belmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, how much of this sales increase for the Ram truck over at the Silverado is caused by the fact that the Ram has a half-ton diesel, where the Silverado does not? I would like to see the figures of what the percentage of diesels are sold by Ram. Thank you very much. Bye.
Yeah, the numbers that I have from Chrysler, from FCA and ALLC does not call out diesel sales from Hemi sales from regular sales. So
I have the information in an email from today, but I don't remember
it.
But I
mean, I have a feeling though that the number
probably less than 10%.
Yeah, and I think so. Let's just say it's less than 10%, and you know, there's not a vast difference between the sales of the Silverado. We had the Ram pickup was at 47,792, Silverado 45,380. You know, so we're talking here. Couple thousand units, but I mean, I think the surprising thing is that, you know, you had a truck that was so you know, second place dominant, mm-hmm. Silverado, now not. So,
but what's the year to date? I mean, you have to, you know, think about a year ago. The Ram might
you
have
also
had.
You have to factor in incentives as well, whether there was a sale going on.
Right, I can get the year to date here. Let me see. Total Ram pickup year to date, they're at 477,671. Or no, I'm sorry. Yeah, 477,671. And then we're looking for Silverado. Is that 585,196?
Yeah, so it's outselling it. So maybe this is an aberration. So we got Mike McAllister said, is it possible that Chevy trucks are down because of men listening to Donald Trump's doom and gloom remarks? well, that doesn't explain why the Ram would be going up, because you'd have the same doom and gloom. Bob Montgomery, Prius Prime is so slow on all electric, 15 seconds to 60 miles per hour. Remember when the Volt was slammed for seating only four? I mean, I don't think anybody buys
an electric vehicle
or a hybrid vehicle for zero to 60. and
except maybe a Tesla, but I mean, but that's the whole other.
Yeah, I mean, electric cars are fast by their nature. Hybrid cars, and I mean, I think that you know, we heard that. You know, they wanted to get some better performance. You know, Christy, as you were saying, it was about 84 miles per hour that can go electric on that. I mean, which is sort of crazy, because probably you're not going to get the 25-mile range.
You'll drain the battery very quickly.
Yeah, you put in it. It can happen. But, I mean, in that four-seater thing, I mean, that's but again, I think that the people who buy these, it's more of a specialty sort of choice versus the – because, I mean, what is the normal the normal Prius liftback, it gets above 50 miles per gallon.
55? So, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, if that's, you know, if that's your space. Okay, we've got one more question, and then we'll wrap this up. So Rafi from Baton Rouge, are vehicles made in a different country lower in quality than those made in their country of origin, or is this just a wrong perception?
It's a wrong perception.
Okay, why is it a wrong perception?
Well, I think because this has become a global industry that works on, and if you go from plants in China to the United States, there's really, the processes are all the same. The processes that are used to build a vehicle are pretty much the same around the world, especially high-profile plants that build vehicles for export, like for export from Japan to the United States or from the United States to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Or from the United Kingdom to Europe, these plants are all kept at a very, very high level of process and automation in order to ensure a quality build.
Yes, but you certainly used to hear about those folks that would only buy the Civic built in Japan.
Right.
Not the Civic built in Ohio, or who only want the BMW built in Germany, not the BMW built in South Carolina. Mm. So I know where he's coming from, but yes, erroneous perception.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it comes down to the thing, though, is that, you know, if you know, you buy a German car, you want it to be a German car. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Not made by some guy who's, you know,
watches NASCAR on the weekends.
Yeah, or something like that, or, you know, in South Carolina. Yeah. But, you know, and it all seems to me that, you know, we're talking about, like, Camry. I mean, Camry is made here, and Camry isn't really that same car anywhere else in the world, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so in many ways, it's almost, like, more American than...
It's unique. And that's the point that the Toyota officials make, right, too, is that it's probably the most American car. I think there's surveys that show it has more American parts than
at what Hyundai and Kia are doing, I mean, they're very careful. They're paying great attention to making the build quality of their products that are mm-hmm. that are produced here as, you know... maybe even higher than they do in their home markets.
Perhaps. There's a lot of turmoil right now at Hyundai. Yeah.
And the same goes for cars built in Mexico. I mean, these are global companies that maintain...
And so, for example, one of the cars introduced in Paris, the Audi Q5, will be built in Mexico. I mean, it's... I don't even think... It's built in Mexico, India, and China. I don't even think it's built in Germany or anywhere else. Or the Audi TT, which is made in Hungary. Right.
And Ram and pickup trucks and Silverado pickup trucks are both built in Mexico too. But we don't want.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
All right. We're all here in Farmington, mm-hmm. so the genuine thing. So, mm-hmm. Christy.
Yeah.
Good seeing you.
Good seeing
Thanks
you, Gary.
For coming,
so. Thank you for having me.
So. You, WardsAuto.com. Okay,
yes.
You can see her stuff. Joe Sesney,
mm-hmm.
Oakland Press.
Or TheDetroitBureau.com.
Right. So thank you guys for coming. I want to thank you all for watching. And John will be here next week with me, and we'll do another show. So thank you. See you next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
We're back.
Oh, we're still live, but yeah, we got a lot of stuff in.
We did. It was a good, thorough conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was surprised to see. I thought you were going to bring up the Accord, because remember the conversation we had with Jeff Conrad back in July mm-hmm. about how great Honda cars were doing.
And they were great.
Accord fell off a cliff last month.
The key there was when they put out the press release saying Honda trucks do great, and then their wholesales, their total were down for the month.
Right.
But that was...
Accord was down 22.6. Fall off a cliff is probably strong, but it was a big decline for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're down 0.5%. They're flat for the year now.
Okay.
The car or Honda?
The car.
The car. Yeah, how many Accords have been sold for the year?
346,743, so still pretty strong. Civic had a flat month, which...
That's kind of a surprise because Civic has gotten so many good notices, so many good reviews lately.
It has, and, you know, it's still, I don't think it's, has it been on the market for a year now, or is it still under a year old?
Well,
it's still relatively new.
But Civic is up for the year, but it was down for the month.
Yeah.
But it was down for the month, like, almost infinitesimally.
Yeah, but... They had been seeing increases, so I thought that it being
103
flat.
103 cars difference from
last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that could just be inventory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I noticed that the Equus outsold the Genesis G90. 60 Equus sales last month versus 10 Genesis G90. So people were liking those closeout prices for the...
But I wonder how the strike is going to do to what's going to do to the
Ooh,
Genesis.
Very good point.
Yeah. And the thing
Genesis
was pricey, you know, because you mentioned, and I saw that the 775 Continentals. Have you seen a Continental?
I've seen a couple, but I think they've all had manufacturer's plates. Yeah.
I haven't seen one in the white, and it was just like...
They're all sold in Florida.
I mean, when did it come out? I mean, obviously it came out like last month, but I mean...
Yeah, they kind of were stealth with the launch.
I mean, I haven't even seen, what's his name, McConaughey doing an ad for him.
Mm-hmm. That's true. This is probably a soft launch where they just sort of put it out there and they're just waiting to get feedback, waiting to see how it's performing,
but
and then they'll...
You can't, well, it goes... If you don't talk about it, how can you... How
well,
are you
maybe,
ever going to...
Maybe you would just want to get some out...
Early feedback.
Yeah, into the the hands of real people and not say much about it.
Ford has had problems with launches in recent years, right?
Oh, yeah,
Escape
they have.
And, hey, we can talk freely here.
I'm just saying. Just so you know,
being analytical.
I've got no problem. But that really surprised me. I mean, I would have thought that because this is such an important car for them, that they would have really made a big deal out of it. And I know that they're somewhat sensitive to the fact that, there are some people who doubt the longevity,
that it's for real. Yeah.
The longevity of that brand and
of Lincoln.
The opportunity of those guys to, because, if you look at the sales of the MKZ and the MKS, especially
But I think it's the thing about Lincoln, though. I think they can keep it alive in China for a launch, like, it become a version of Buick, where it just lives on in China indefinitely while sales are so-so in the United States. I think Lincoln has the potential to be that kind of a brand.
But doesn't everybody want it to? I mean,
do well in China.
Yeah, I mean,
everybody wants it. But I'm saying that this brand, but it might just fade away in the United States. But it will live. It won't disappear completely because.
I have a hard time believing that they would do that. I honestly don't think that.
But then, how are they going to sell more cars in the United States? Do you have the magic formula for Lincoln selling more cars in the United States?
Well, I think basically, I mean, if
other than spending $10 trillion.
Well, no, I mean, one of the things that occurred to me was the fact when I was looking, looking at the numbers that, okay, so if you look at the the Cadillac showroom, you got ATS, CT6, CTS, ELR, Escalade, ESV, XT5, and XTS. And actually, the XTS was up by 21.8%.
Wow.
And then you look at what Lincoln has. And so Lincoln has the MKZ, the MKS, Continental, MKC, MKX, MKT, Navigator. I mean, it's got a... MKZ, mid-cycle refresh. I mean, it's got the front end. MKS, when's that been changed?
Yeah.
Continental, new car, MKC, that's now a couple years old, right?
Mm-hmm. So they need more product and fresher product is what your take on it.
I think that's... I mean,
the back costs money.
Well, yeah. I mean, didn't Denishin get a big pile of cash from the general?
Yes, the story. From what you hear from inside GM, he seems to be running through it at an alarming clip too.
But he got it right. I mean, and so,
yeah. so where's the pile of cash from Mark Fields to
the
Lincoln leader of Lincoln? I don't remember the guy's name.
Yeah. I can see him.
Who's the
Kumar.
Name?
That's right. Yeah,
Kumar Galhora.
Okay.
And right. So we were saying, okay, we haven't heard anything about this. And how many zillion ads have you seen with people walking backwards and Cadillacs driving through, New York and on and on and on. I mean, it's like these guys are making a big deal out of it.
The money? Where's the money, Mark?
Well, the thing of it is that basically what we do for a living is try to hear this stuff, right? I mean, we're hyper aware of what's going on. Just think of our average people.
Right. Oh, yeah. They hear nothing, right? I mean, they would just
their
would
last
go right
Lincoln
over
reference
there.
Was the car that their grandfather drove.
Or McConaughey falling into a swimming pool.
Yes.
I mean, it's just...
And I'm not even sure that the McConaughey ads, for all their ink that they've gotten or all the buzz that they've created, people actually link them to refer back to Lincoln in the end.
Yeah.
Or is it all about Matthew McConaughey's ego and the rest of it? Lincoln, is there a car attached to this, or is that...
That's true, because how many times do you guys see a non-automotive ad and remember what it was about? or what product it was for. You know,
right,
you might
exactly.
remember.
And I'm afraid they've fallen into that trap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But no, it's. But so, I mean, I still think that, you know, sales were reasonably well. But I mean, there are these just real serious anomalies that, you know, and maybe it's just, maybe it's inventory. Maybe they don't have enough Silverados to sell. Maybe they've got to put on a third shift and
inventory for large pickups is up 11.1%.
That goes back
at this point in time.
About.
So they're gearing up for a good fourth quarter, or hoping for a good fourth quarter.
Oh, the last time I'd want to buy a pickup truck would be when there's snow on the ground.
Well, you have to look at things like building permits and stuff like that, too. And if the business is going well, they're just not.
I wonder if the decline in the U.S. oil industry.
Oh, that's another one. That's another one. That's another big.
All those tar sands.
Purchaser of pickup trucks is in the oil patch, and that's been down. Like there was a story, it was a story out of Oklahoma, and they said the state of Oklahoma's revenues have fallen they were talking about education, and they said the state of Oklahoma's revenues had fallen by 15%, which means that the whole economy in the state is flat.
Right.
And Oklahoma is a pretty good-sized pickup truck market, so there's...
Mm-hmm.
Because of the oil industry.
Yeah. Did you go to the Texas State Fair?
No, I didn't go to the Texas State Fair.
I'm wondering how the Texas market is doing this year.
Right.
Obviously, they're very oil dependent as well.
Corn dogs through the roof. All right. I'm sure they want to go home.
All right.
And listen to us opine.
Mm-hmm.